bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't gamble. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel Sportsbook. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague, Payne Insider, and we encourage you to go to FanDuel.com/bettheboard. Take advantage of all the generous sign-up bonuses there. New users up to a $2,000 free bet. Bet the preseason, bet Major League Baseball, bet the NFL regular season. FanDuel has you covered this upcoming football season. And Payne, it didn't take us long in 2021 to get our first best bet winner of the season.
Ah, you remember that? Yes.
What do you mean I remember that? We keep track of these things around here. We don't just sweep them under the rug, wins or losses.
I know. It was a unexpected quarterback that was not supposed to play that showed up. But fortunately, he didn't have much to offer after just 2 or 3 days of camp. But that was an interesting story because we didn't think Kellen Mond was going to play. The actual Vikings team site reported at like 7 p.m. on the 12th that it was unlikely he was going to play. No one knew he was going to play. Except Mike Zimmer, who threw him in there and played him almost three quarters after Jake Browning threw up all over himself. So it was a good start to the season getting that out of the way. But we kind of talk about this a little bit past the win, right? Like that's what everyone wants. Everyone wants the win. It was a game we gave out a pick at close three. And I think that's really the important part of this when you're trying to figure out information to follow, because there's never going to be a long enough sample size of anyone you're tailing for a singular season, if you're listening to them on the radio or podcast or video, wherever you're consuming your gambling information, there's never going to be a long enough sample size. So how do you judge in a small sample size? And it's like, are you beating the closing line? Are you listening to information that might pop or break days after that information comes out? And I think that's the interesting part about this podcast, because last year, I'll be candid, off the top of my head, I was looking at the sheet earlier, and I think we released 46 best bets last year. We won a third of a position for the entire season. It was our worst season to date. But of those 46 best bets, only two moved against us, and one was COVID-related. Every other game moved in our favor. So while it was our worst season, it was one, still profitable, and two, the thing you're looking for over a short sample size is we crushed the closing line virtually every single time.
Hey, that's the name of the game in this business, is trying to take advantage, like you said, of the information that's out there, getting your money in good, and hoping for the best when you put yourself in that advantageous position. I know there were a bunch of preseason moves over the weekend. Of course, Denver gets there with relative ease in that commanding 33-6 victory.
We did lose, Payne, personally, the 7-point move, which was altogether
riveting. I was going to be honest there that, you mean what, us betting Jacksonville plus three, having the game taken off the board, move 4.5 points after we bet it, and even closing, I saw upwards of four and a half out here in the desert. 7-point move,
yeah. It was fortunate that you were at the Raider game and you did not get to see Urban Meyer's offense in all its glory.
I think I watched one series when I was waiting in line for a beer during the Raiders pregame, and I went, nah, I'm going to try and focus on the game at hand. The Nathan Peterman experience, let me tell you, is a religious revival, watching him go out there and take every snap for a full four quarters. But at the same time, yes, I'm glad I didn't watch that. I do have it on the docket to go back and see what I missed between the Jags and Browns. But alas, we're not able to cash that contest. Where do we stand update-wise? Last check over the weekend, I saw north of 600 signups. Do you want to give folks the details there and how they can get involved?
Yep, our annual Pick 5 NFL contest is back. This is year 5, a $6,000 prize pool, weekly winners as well. Sign up, bettheboardcontest.com, 100% free to join. Pick 5 games each week, and there you have it. That's it. Very simple. There will be a link in the description of this podcast, so it'll take you right there.
It was funny. I was at a barbecue yesterday afternoon, one of our friends going away parties, and a couple of the guys there in the poker community go, "Hey, you guys put on quite the free roll there." I said, "Yeah, as long as you guys don't bail after 3 weeks, you might want to stay in the contest for the full 18-week regular season and see if you can win some swag this time around."
It's really interesting because we have a great turnout every year, and the winners seem to do as well, if not better, than some of the competitions in Vegas. So, one, it's a free roll, so you'd be joining anyways. But if you can't make it out to Vegas, or you don't have the funds to join a pool out west, this is the alternative option, and it's absolutely free to join. BetTheBoardContest.com.
Exactly. That's the name of the game. We know everyone has different bankroll constraints out there. This one you can do from the confines of your home. Doesn't require a proxy. Doesn't require a trip out here to the desert. You can put your money where your mouth is. Best part is you don't have to put up money. You can still take home all sorts of cash and prizes. Did want to ask you, Payne, before we get into the NFC North, and I'm sure Bear fans are on the edge of their seat waiting to hear what I have to say about Justin Fields. Did you see anything week one of the preseason that you caught by surprise or anything else along those lines? I know you watch a lot of the games in real time before you'll go back and review a ton of footage as well once we get off the show today.
Not really. I think the one thing that stood out to me is with this change in preseason schedule, the philosophies have been wildly different. Some teams are playing their starters up till a full quarter or more. Other teams, like McVay, he's standing by like, "I'm not playing my quarterback in any preseason game ever." So a lot of the strategies are interesting, and I believe, I can't remember who posted it, but basically the last three Super Bowl winners had played some level of their starters. And then you had someone like Mike Zimmer bitching and moaning any chance he could this past week about how poor his team played, yet he benched 21 of 22 potential starters. So that was the one thing that was really interesting. I thought there might be a little more uniformity in terms of, hey, new preseason schedule, just three games. Teams are going to have a little bit of a same style of approach, but it was just drastically different across the board.
I will say one thing that's funny, watching the entire first half of that Vikings-Broncos game, the incredulity of the Vikings announcers, that Drew Locke was out there, not just for one series, but two. Oh my God, Jerry Jeudy's still on the field. I'm sitting there laughing going, yes, this is what the Broncos were going to do. But the Vikings announcers were almost angry that the Broncos were playing their starters like it was a little league game. And hey, look, we've pulled our guys. You have to pull your guys as well. We're not out here to see one team get manhandled.
Is that a 5 or 6 syllable word there that you just broke out on a Monday morning after claiming you are a little under the weather?
I'm going to have to check it out. I think it's 5 if I can count. I mean, I run out of fingers on one hand.
Yeah, you're right. It's 5. The state of being unwilling or unable to believe something. There you go. For our listeners at home, Todd broke out a $7 word on a Monday morning.
Hey, we may have some folks out there who are studying for, you know, college placement exams and all that. We don't encourage underage gambling, but the reality of it is there could be a Todd Furman or Payne Insider at 16 years of age tuning in. So if we can make them smarter, not just raise their football IQ, but also their ACT and SAT scores, then we're doing the Lord's work around these parts.
I did notice, and you sent me a clip, and we'll just kind of keep it at that. But in terms of gambling or becoming professional bettors, it was interesting to hear something that I had been talking about for the last like 3 or 4 years. If you're getting into this business, don't. And there was a video this week that surfaced of, you know, a well-respected bettor kind of saying the same thing that made its way across, which is interesting. So practice those big words for your SATs and all your tests and all that. And gambling probably isn't the environment to join right now with how it stands.
Yeah, it is a much different space than when you and I both entered it years ago. Geez. And we'll see. Might be the understatement of the podcast, maybe in the history of this particular show. But we'll see the evolution and how things continue to go. Again, more fuel for the end of the season podcast when we may lay it all out there. Kind of like the Rose tell-all type situation for those folks that watch The Bachelor. All right, let's get into the games, or the teams, I should say, themselves. And we'll start, as we've done through the first three podcasts.
I'm going to interrupt you here, because after a 9-minute intro in which we didn't talk about a singular game, you concluded with a Bachelor reference. I mean, that if anyone was still listening, you just sent them for the exit.
Well, I mean, I did. You know what? I mean, I probably shouldn't divulge this on air, so I won't. So we'll leave that on the side. I actually haven't watched that show probably in like, I want to say 4 or 5 years. It's probably since I got into it, but amazing. It still creates content on social media. But no, it is not in my regular rotation by any stretch of the imagination.
The Chicago Bears, will they be in your regular rotation of viewing on Sundays this week or this year?
We'll find out. I'm not sure if Bears fans are going to want to roll out the red carpet after their response on Saturday. But when we look at the Bears, they're 5-1 underdogs to win the NFC North at FanDuel Sportsbook. You look at their win total, it's 7.5, shaded to the under, minus $1.20. Credit to some of my Fox Sports colleagues who found a nugget here. And I understand why Bears are so sensitive when you take shots at their starting quarterbacks. The pain, the last Bears quarterback that was named first team All-Pro happened back in 1950. It was a quarterback by the name of Johnny Lujack. So when you take shots at Justin Fields, who is supposed to be this great revelation and completely innovate the quarterback position, I understand the increased sensitivity there. This was a Bears team last year who started out hot 5-1, finished 3-7 down the stretch, but did find a way to back into the postseason. They finished at 500 or worse in 7 of the last 8 seasons, but to Matt Nagy's credit, they have reached the postseason in 2 of 3 seasons where he's been at the helm. When you look at the team's offensive identity, they've really lacked one. It's a bit problematic when that's in your head coach's DNA, and maybe more so for Bears fans. They're just 1-9 the last 10 games with the Packers. But as you begin to break down this Bears team, I feel Fields provides a logical starting point. Everyone wanted to anoint him the next great Chicago Bear. I had to throw a little bit of water on that fire going, you know what quarterback actually performed better in his preseason debut? Mitchell Trubisky, the man they jettisoned to Buffalo and didn't pick up his option for the fifth year.
It's really an interesting offseason in the sense that if you're on social media, the clicks, the buzz, the retweets, the favorites seem to be coming from anointing all these young quarterbacks as the next great thing. I mean, Trey Lance threw a touchdown pass on, was it his first throw or second throw?
Yeah, I think it was his second.
And then you didn't hear anything about the 5-for-14 completion rate the rest of the way. It was just that one play. We all know he's talented, right? And we all know Justin Fields has talent, and he's probably provides the Bears a spark, and certainly it's the quarterback that will allow them to have a little bit more variance. But at this point, to me, the Bears' success offensively comes down to Matt Nagy. And what is that guy? Because to this point, he's been nothing more than a byproduct of Andy Reid's success. He's not someone that's been able to stand on his own merits. Every single year, the Bears' offense has regressed under Nagy. And you start to look at some of these numbers, they're staggering. He started in 2018 with the 20th most efficient offense, dropped to 25th in 2019. And then if you remember, Todd, it was a game we broke down. I believe it was a Thursday night game, so it was on one of our Thursday podcasts. It was Vikings-Bears. And he gave up play calling duties to Bill Lazor.
Oh, the Monday nighter.
Was that a Monday nighter? Okay, so it was Monday
night. Yeah, because I think the Bears played the Bucks last year. It was their Thursday night game, I believe. Memory serves me correct.
You're spot on. And so he basically told Bill Lazor, like on a Thursday or Friday, like, hey, you're going to call the plays for the Monday night game. And at the point Nagy gave up play calling duties last year, Chicago was 28th in offensive efficiency. This is year 4 for Nagy. So unless he struck the lotto with Justin Fields, Nagy's out of a job at some point before next season. Now, he came out early this offseason, it was like, hey, I'm taking back play calling duties again. So he's not going to die on somebody else's sword. It's going to be on his own merit if he doesn't survive this. But I can tell you, it seems like Chicago's content trotting out this Nagy-Dalton combination, at least at the beginning part of the season. And that's probably not a good combination because it's a coach that hasn't produced an above average rate offensively in 3 years, and the offense is going to be ran by a 34-year-old quarterback that wasn't good enough for the Bengals organization, right? And produced last season 17% below an average quarterback. You can see why the Bears win total has dropped a little bit. Now, whoever's starting under center, whether it's Dalton or Fields or both of them at some point this season, Nagy's got to figure things out, man. We talk about this all the time, like making the quarterback's job easier. Throw on first down. Use heavy formations a little bit more, right? There's no reason when you look at the makeup of the Bears roster and their offensive construction that these things aren't happening. In 3 years under Nagy, the Bears O-line's finished with an average ranking of 27th in line yards. The O-line's gotten zero push, right? Nothing. And if you're a Bears fan, you're like, that's pretty true. Like, we can't move anybody. And yet Nagy's 51% run on first downs the first three quarters last year. And you look at the production on those first down runs the first three quarters. Chicago's 23rd in success rate. But passes over that same stretch, Chicago is 6th in success rate. A 16% increase in production when Nagy dialed up pass on first down the first three quarters. He runs it more than throws it with a horrific blocking O-line. It makes no sense. I think we joked about last offseason, Todd, about Ryan Pace picking up every tight end known to mankind. I think they had like 8 tight ends on the roster at one point. But Nagy used 2 tight end sets 19% of the time. He lived in 3 wide sets. And when the Bears trotted out 3 wide sets, their efficiency was 7% below an average offense. With 2 tight end sets, Chicago was 5% above average. And yet, despite the roster construction and despite the production, Nagy didn't do what was good for the offense. So, you know, you had this GM just load the roster with tight ends, and it just wasn't ever used. You know, Nagy's like, gonna do my own thing. So it's really interesting to see what the offense looks like this year. The schedule difficulty increases big time. Bears offense goes from facing a bottom 5 schedule of defenses last year to an average schedule this year. The improvements made to the O-line in the offseason haven't quite come to fruition yet. Tevin Jenkins, 39th pick from Oklahoma State, hasn't practiced yet due to back injury. The same injury that nagged him in college. He is your projected left tackle. Jermaine Ifedi, the projected starting right tackle, is also out right now. James Daniels, the starting right guard, has been missing in action. These guys need to get back and start building some continuity if that line's going to improve. I don't like the Bears offense, but in saying that and kind of going back to Justin Fields, I think there's some variance which can equate to positivity. If Justin Fields looks like a first-round quarterback, then stock up, you know? But Fields hasn't been looking great through camp. Maybe he's a gamer. But there's a lot of what I've been hearing is he's not throwing with anticipation. That was a little bit of his weakness at Ohio State. He's not seeing everything. You know, there's young guys on the own line. If they can't gel, that'll be trouble, but they might be able to improve as time goes on. You know, you had a disappointing year from Cole Kmet as a rookie, but he's got a lot of upside. There's weapons there that are interesting. I have a man crush on Allen Robinson. He's just been able to dominate at basically every level of the route tree. Darnell Mooney has an elite trait with his speed, so there is hope, and I think eventually, if not early, it's a tough opener, right, throwing Justin Fields into that. But after a couple of weeks, I think he does at least provide an ability with his legs to at least change some of the looks you're going to see defensively and at least provide some hope. Because I think if you say, hey, I'm trotting out Andy Dalton there and let me know what you think on this, and we start the season 0-4, Matt Nagy is going to have a tough time keeping his job. But if you start Justin Fields and there is some element of hope, and even if you win 8 or 9 games, but it looks like you have your franchise quarterback, then the GM and coach might be able to save themselves for another season.
I think it's an interesting conundrum because I can see it both ways, that if Nagy and Pace go, hey, look, we want to wait on Justin Fields, we don't want to throw him to the wolves, you can kind of sugarcoat a potentially slow start. But the issue for the Bears' schedule is you try and figure out, okay, Fields playing opening night in prime time against the Rams and Aaron Donald. Not quite sure that's the best recipe for success. Do you run him back week 2? I don't know if that's quite when you want to do it, where you have an Andy Dalton type revenge scenario, him playing against his former team in the Bengals. Week 3, you go to Cleveland, and then you have back-to-back games, which might provide a logical landing spot if you wanted to give Fields a chance to work against inferior defenses in the Detroit Lions, and then at Las Vegas in early October. The problem from their pain, they go through a 5-week stretch after, which is going to test any quarterback's mettle, which include games against Green Bay, at Tampa Bay, home against San Francisco, at Pittsburgh on Monday night, and yep, we get a bye week insert in there before the Baltimore Ravens come to town. So it's not as like, you know, there's a huge logical window to get Fields out there. So I think it's going to be fascinating to try and watch how quick a hook that they're going to have on Andy Dalton early on.
Yeah, at some point you just have to rip the Band-Aid off.
Agreed.
And you probably are looking at that range of having the two cupcake defenses and hoping that he's able to mature enough when the schedule gets a little bit more difficult. But this is one of the league's most difficult schedules this year when you look at it from a win totals perspective. Now, I want to dig into Justin Fields a little bit more because, you know, the first two drives he enters the game against the Dolphins and he's backed up in his own end, and that's going to change play calling dramatically. But then a lot of his success was predicated on playing third and fourth team defenders. Now, he looked very good, but I hope he's able to hit a wide open tight end streaking down the left hash. And when we talk about preseason games, Todd, we start to look at some of the backup quarterbacks. It's like, do these guys have legs? Because that's a big advantage if they do in a preseason game when you're just trying to manufacture offense in the third and fourth quarters in these preseason games. So what was noticeable when you talk about just a starting perspective, the Dolphins' talent was far superior to what Chicago had. So much so that even though Tua was picked off in the end zone, he was moving the ball all over without four of his top five weapons. And I think that'll be the other interesting element to this Bears team is, does the defense take another step back?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, personnel remains largely the same for the Bears. You do lose Kyle Fuller. You add in Desmond Trufant, hopefully to fortify that secondary. But when you look at the Bears, you know, 3 years ago we talked about it. There was a team that lived on forcing turnovers. They created short fields for their offense, and you knew a regression was coming from that side of the ball. The reality of it is the Bears last year were amongst one of the best teams in the entire NFL as far as red zone defense is concerned, holding opponents to touchdowns on a shade less than 55% of their opportunities. But overall, they had the NFL's 14th ranked scoring defense. They gave up more than 23 points per game after ranking top 10 in each of the previous three seasons. And you've seen their takeaway numbers really subside. 37 over the last two seasons compared to 36 in just 2018 alone. Now, they do get Eddie Goldman back to help clog the middle. Roquan Smith has turned into more of a force as far as the linebackers are concerned. And you started to see what Bill Allnichols could provide in the absence of Eddie Goldman. Akeem Hicks pushing for an extension. We'll see how much he can stay on the field for. But Robert Quinn, Payne, I have to imagine there are a lot of Bears fans and folks sitting in the front office going, wait, we committed how much to this guy and we got what level of productivity? Hard to believe this Bears defense can go anywhere but down.
It's really interesting because I do like the pedigree of their new DC, Sean Desai. He's been with Chicago since 2013. He's climbed his way up the ladder. He constantly praises Vic Fangio any chance he gets and calls him his mentor. And Desai's alluded to the fact that he's not going to change much. It's all about tuning up and refining because he likes the Fangio scheme. What I would expect is more disguise and coverages because Chuck Pagano was very predictable and vanilla in the secondary last year. I think this defense will look more like Fangio from a coverage scheme perspective where they're going to show the quarterback something pre-snap, then roll into coverage they actually want to be in post-snap. If you've paid close attention and you hit this perfectly, Chicago's defense the last few seasons have had these incremental downgrades as players in the system get older, or there's some cap casualties that force guys out of town, or there's regression in some of the turnover metrics that you mentioned. And then you've also had a downgrading in DCs. It's so much tougher, I think, to the naked eye, identifying an elite defense regressing to good than a good defense dipping all the way to bad. So we haven't really seen it at the national level that Chicago's defense has been regressing. Everyone still thinks it's like this elite defense. But if you're looking metrically and really digging into these things, pressure rates have dipped substantially, right? 2018 defense with Fangio and a 27-year-old Khalil Mack registered a 33% pressure rate as a team that year. Fangio leaves, and in 2019, Chicago's pressure rate dips to 29%. And then last year under Pagano, it dipped again to 23%. The lower pressure rate impacts the secondary, so coverage has regressed as well. Going back to 18 with Fangio, the Bears were number one in defensive pass efficiency. 2019, it fell to 11th, and last year, 13th. So again, from the surface, when you look at Chicago and the parts of the field where they got torched, it would appear to me it's scheme-driven or lack of depth. And I think that kind of goes into what we've talked about, right? Like the coaching has gone down, the departing of some players. Because if you really look, the Bears did a good job defending opposing teams' number one and two receivers. But the rest of the defense and coverage got picked on. The Bears were dead last in defensive pass efficiency defending any other receiver that wasn't a first or second option. And I think that's probably the biggest question mark this season as well. You hope Sean Desai does mimic Fangio's coverage schemes, and that helps. But Jalen Johnson, that's going to be your horse. And I think he's got potential, and he performed really well as a rookie, showed he was willing to play lots of press man coverage. But if he's your number one, there's some questions there, especially he's coming off his third shoulder surgery. Eddie Jackson, one of the league's best safeties. Let's see if he can return to form. Tayshawn Gibson had a solid year, but I think the biggest question by far is cornerback too. You mentioned Kyle Fuller leaving. He went and rejoined Vic Fangio in Denver. They brought in Desmond Trufant. He hasn't been able to stay healthy. Artie Burns is also on the roster. Can he be serviceable? I don't know, but he's also coming back from injury. All the rave seems to be about this young kid, Kendall Vildor. He's right now, I think, the leader in the clubhouse for the number two job. He's a high-end two-star recruit that was a fifth-round pick from Georgia Southern last year. He gave up 16 catches on 21 targets, two of which were touchdowns, and allowed a 124 passer rating. Doesn't mean Vildor can't grow, but that's not the prototypical traits of a starting corner in the NFL. Let's see what comes of that. But what I do know is the Bears defense plays a top five schedule of offenses this season, a top five schedule of passing and pass blocking offenses, and the most difficult run schedule. And so when you mentioned Akeem Nicks, Hicks kind of holding out a little bit and wanting a new contract, if his agent's smart, he's probably going to bring that up and tell the organization, like, you need me, looking at this schedule. The quarterbacks Chicago faces is scary. Burrow and Daniel Jones project to be the worst on the entire schedule, but you see Aaron Rodgers twice. You get Brady, Stafford, Cousins twice, Russ, Carr, Lamar and Kyler, Big Ben, and you have the ascending Baker Mayfield in that Browns offense. There's not many quarterbacks on this schedule where you say, like, yeah, we're going to be able to overwhelm those guys. So unless Desai is basically Fangio Jr. and Khalil Mack returns to 2018 form, and Robert Quinn, who you mentioned, I cannot believe that contract. I think we talked about it and joked about it last year. Unless he returns to his 2019 form and the secondary stays healthy, and Danny Trevathan can figure out how to not be the worst cover linebacker in the league, I think we probably see another defensive dip here, Todd.
Going to be an interesting team to watch. I know it's not a popular opinion when you talk about Bears fans, because they have a loyal fan base that lives and dies with this team. So it's always interesting to kind of gauge sentiment, see where the level of optimism may or may not be. And of course, it all stems from them trading up, to their credit, to try and get a quarterback that they think can revolutionize their franchise. I do, in the back of my mind, have to wonder how much of that was predicated on passing on some of the elite quarterbacks we've seen in the National Football League now, knowing the increased pressure there and living with that Mitchell Trubisky decision.
Here's what I want to say about this, kind of from a betting perspective and a team perspective, if you are a Bears fan. When you look at the win total of 7.5, it doesn't provide a lot of optimism. But the team does, in my mind, have a ton of variance to them. Because if Justin Fields is the real deal and Sean Desai is Vic Fangio, then you might see value in taking some of the long shot props, right? Make the playoffs at +250 rather than going over the win total. You know, making the wild card at 6-1, something along those lines, where you're kind of projecting a team with a ton of variance. If they suck, they suck, so be it. But the good might be good if Justin Fields is elite, and it could be really good if the defense stays healthy and kind of gets back to form. So it's a team with a ton of variance here. If you told me they won 4 games or you told me they won 10, I probably wouldn't be shocked.
It's a great point, and part of the way you have to go about looking at these betting markets, take advantage of all the options that are available to you. And if you believe that the Bears are going to be able to do something special, trust me, Payne, I'm sure there are plenty of folks out there clamoring to bet Fields to win Rookie of the Year as well at an 8-1 price tag. A team that, in my opinion, doesn't have a high ceiling and it may not have that high a floor would be one of the other members of the NFC North, and that, of course, the Detroit Lions. who find themselves 19-1 underdogs at FanDuel Sportsbook to win the division. Their win total sits at 5, shaded under minus $1.20. When you look at this Lions franchise, I don't need to go through the laundry list of underachievement. Last won a playoff game in 1991, 27 years since they won the division, face a top 5 schedule of opposing offenses. Or overall difficulty, I should say. And if it's not a harbinger of things to come, you always have to love it when a team fires your head trainer just hours before your preseason game against the Buffalo Bills. Payne, I think when you talk about the Detroit Lions, the most logical place to start, maybe even conclude, is with the coaching staff they've assembled. Not just Dan Campbell, but everywhere else underneath him.
And for the listeners, we wanted to approach the Lions differently because this season, there's only going to be varying degrees of bad. As you mentioned, Todd, the win total's 5. A good bit of pro money is on the under. It's why you're seeing a couple 4.5 start to emerge in the market. Detroit is like one team throughout our entire preview series where, you know, Todd and we kind of talked strategy on how to go about breaking down the Lions. And it's because there's this complete regime change and scheme shift on both sides of the ball and a different quarterback under center. Talking about last year is kind of irrelevant, and I think we want to speak more to the big picture about Dan Campbell and the staff and really the Lions organization in general. And I'll start by saying this, and it's not going to be pretty, but Dan Campbell wasn't the Lions' first choice. There was another Campbell, Matt Campbell, from Iowa State, and I think your colleague, Todd, at CBS, Dennis Dodd, broke this story that Matt Campbell turned down almost $70 million to be the Lions coach.
to stay in Ames, Iowa, nonetheless.
The organization is that bad. And we've seen it over time, right? You force these elite Hall of Famers in their primes to retire early in Barry Sanders and Megatron. It really tells you all you need to know. But in comes Dan Campbell, and there's a lot of guys in this league that will sing his praises. Sean Payton's one of them. Campbell always seems to be placed higher within the list of head coaches than coordinators. He's either been a tight ends coach or an interim head coach, and occasionally he'll get tagged with assistant head coach, even though he's a day-to-day tight ends coach. He's never called plays at this level on either side effectively, right? So you've got a CEO, really. And his job as a CEO is to bring in smart people and just manage the team. He's not my style of coach. I've dealt with him down here in Miami for multiple seasons, and he held the interim job in 15, I believe it was, when Philbin got fired. He's this rah-rah guy, right? Pound the table. We're going to be more physical than the other team type coach. Not really strategic or X's and O's driven. Doesn't seem to be into analytics. You heard his opening presser, and he's talking about, you know, chewing the leg off the other team. It's very bizarre. Now, Miami won its first two games under Campbell with the interim tag, and then the rah-rah wore off. They went 3-7 down the stretch. And I just wonder how long that approach can work when you're losing lots of games. You look at the staff he's put together. Really interesting. I mean, you hire Anthony Lynn as your offensive coordinator, former running backs coach. Lynn was a interim head coach / OC in Buffalo in 2016, and he had the most run-heavy offense in the league. And then in 19 and 20, he was with the Chargers, and they lost 20 regular season games. And the offense basically had a governor on it. And you start to look at this preseason game, and you don't want to take too much from it, but Dan Campbell claimed the Lions were treating it like the Super Bowl, and he played his starters for a full quarter. And you're trying to implement these new systems. So you're trying to do things that would help you for the regular season, I would think. And somehow Anthony Lynn ran on 52% of first downs in a game they never let in for 58.5 minutes. So, and then he goes and botches the endgame situation offensively on the go-ahead drive because he couldn't manage a clock. And so there's a lot of questions from a coaching perspective. And then you move past that and you look at the rest of the hires. Anthony Lynn and Dan Campbell said, hey, we're not going to hire someone that maybe has a little bit different mindset to hear other ideas. No, we're going to hire Deuce Staley, another running back and running backs coach. And he played in Philly for 7 years. He coached in Philly for 10 years, was running backs coach for the last 8. And they never moved him up past running back coach, despite interviewing for the OC job multiple times. They basically, to appease one of their own, they gave him this foreign title of assistant head coach. But the bottom line is, Deuce Staley made a lateral move after 8 years to a lesser organization. Does that tell you what he is? And I completely understand when you look at the makeup of this roster and you look at some of the construction of it, the O-line's probably the best position group on the Detroit Lions roster. And then you have maybe the most talented offensive weapon is your running back in Swift. But if you think Jared Goff, in a year where he's trying to regain his confidence, is going to be the guy to bail you out on third and long all season, you got another thing coming. And then defensively, it's like, who did he hire? Aaron Glenn. And I think you and I are being both 80s babies. You're going to remember Glenn as this Jets defensive back with the oversized jersey and the extra long towel. But, I mean, he's been the Saints DB coach for the last five seasons. And you can certainly give him credit for part of the defensive rebuild, although I think that goes mostly to Dennis Allen. But what's interesting over the last few seasons is you could pinpoint the area of the defense and hell, the Saints' entire team, where their weakest link was, and it seemed to be the secondary. They were constantly trying to add little parts like Janoris Jenkins and Malcolm Jenkins, and there was this constant retooling in the secondary. Aaron Glenn coached Marshawn Lattimore directly, very hands-on. And Marshawn Lattimore has regressed every single season he's been in the league. As a rookie, he played at a Pro Bowl level. Lockdown type corner. He's regressed in his second season, was above average in 19, and last year he was a below average corner. All on Aaron Glenn's watch. And so the Lions are going to have to navigate this season, and you mentioned this perfectly, playing one of the very best schedules of offenses. And you're looking at the overall strength of schedule according to win totals. The Lions play the seventh most difficult schedule. I will end it on this, Todd, because I want to go glass half full here before we just turn every Detroit Lions fan away from listening to this podcast forever.
There are only seven of them out there, so if all seven happen to be listening to the podcast, we appreciate you guys being loyal subscribers to Bet the Board.
If you look ahead to 2022 and beyond, at least Dan Campbell and the staff are going to have the opportunity to turn this around. They're going to be able to die on their own sword. They're going to have a say because cap-wise, Detroit has above-average money to spend in 2022, and it'll increase even more if they can somehow get Jared Goff off the books. And if you look at current-day draft capital and assign value to each pick every organization has, the Lions have the most draft capital as we speak right now, Todd.
Going to be interesting. It's a team who clearly hasn't quite hit rock bottom just yet, and they've hit rock bottom a number of times over the last decade or so. We'll see exactly what the first trip around the league looks like for Dan Campbell as head man of a Lions team that needs to figure out its offensive identity to execute, and defensively a team that gave up 30-plus points in six straight games to close out last year, allowed 40 or more in five games a season ago. We'll see how things look in the Motor City this year. From Detroit to northern Wisconsin, we go with the Green Bay Packers. And you look at Green Bay, they are a modest $1.45 favorite at FanDuel Sportsbook to win the division. You look at their win total, it sits at 10.5. Shaded to the over, you have to lay $1.20. They're actually the first team paying to lose in the NFC title in back-to-back years since the Philadelphia Eagles did it back in 2002 and 2003. You look at Green Bay's success under Matt LaFleur, a lot of that's been attributed to dominating in their own division, where they've gone 11-1, 14-2 at Lambeau Field over the last two seasons. We know how important it is to hold serve in your own building. And LaFleur's 26 wins place him behind only George Seifert for total wins in your first two seasons and as an NFL head coach. Naturally, the big storyline here all offseason was around Aaron Rodgers. Will he or won't he be the starting quarterback? He, of course, will be back under center there. But one has to ask, will we see the Aaron Rodgers that we saw in 2020 that led him to an MVP caliber season? Or will we see the guy in 2019 that a lot of folks wrote off, not just in gambling circles, but the fantasy world as well?
This feels like we've hit the part of the show that comes up every season, Todd. It's the how good is Green Bay really segment. And
this is a fan base that hates me too, so don't worry about it. The Bears fans are about gonna have to take a number behind Green Bay because I've called Green Bay overrated and overvalued each of the last couple years. So,
and we talked about that regression happening last year, and we were dead wrong. Fortunately, oddsmakers saved our ass because they made the win total so low. Green Bay's regression was already factored into the number and then some, and price is the ultimate determinant for an investment. So we were able to be wrong in our opinion, but we didn't lose any money. Then you have, out of nowhere, Aaron Rodgers just best season ever. You know, his 2019 season in LaFleur's system, like, he finished 20th in total QBR. Last year, Rodgers just went nuclear, third highest QBR for a quarterback all time. And we saw complete buy-in from Rodgers. He was willing to believe in LaFleur's system. He even claimed that he spent time during lockdowns looking at every NFL throw he ever made and noticed some bad habits that he wanted to fix. And when you get someone, you know, as talented as Rodgers is to play within a good system, great things can happen. And if you look at time to throw metrics, Rodgers had his quickest release time in over a decade, which meant he was willing to play within the system and not improvise and try to do it all on his own. And I think the big question heading into this year is, will there be the buy-in from Rodgers again? And how far will he regress personally? Because he just went so nuclear last year that, like, even if he has a good season, it's impossible to replicate 2020. And you start to look at some of the makeup of the team. The O-line lost a few key cogs. And then on top of those, you know, question marks with Rodgers' buy-in and the O-line regressing and him personally coming down to life just a little bit, you look at the schedule Green Bay is going to face. It's the largest difficulty swing year over year. So those are some of the questions for me. Now, Matt LaFleur came out, spoke to the media last week, and he said Aaron Rodgers came into camp with a Zen vibe about him. And LaFleur got Aaron Rodgers to break the team down after the first day of camp. And apparently Rodgers delivered a pretty great speech about buy-in and commitment and living in the moment and accomplishing goals this year. And that's great. It kind of confirms that Rodgers will be a professional and that all the question marks we might have about his rift with the GM and the organization isn't going to be a factor. But again, he can't replicate last season, especially when you look at the schedule. Green Bay projects to face a schedule of defenses top five overall and against the pass, top five against the run and on third downs. Last year, the schedule in those categories were some of the worst in the league. And now you're looking at this offensive line and you lose your all-world center, Corey Linsley. Green Bay allowed Rick Wagner, their starting right tackle, to walk. David Bakhtiari turns 30 in September. He's coming off an ACL tear, which doctors haven't cleared him from yet. And the talk is that he's not going to be ready for week one. So basically what's happened is Jenkins is being cross-trained at left tackle. When you put it all together, you've effectively downgraded all five positions along the O-line early in the season because, again, Linsley and Wagner are gone. And then you're forcing your guards, like Jenkins and Turner, to play out of position at tackle spots where they're not as good. So you've downgraded all five positions along the O-line as it stands right now. Let's see when Bakhtiari returns. But what's really odd here is you're looking at a market price of 10.3 wins, basically. That's the average across the market. And you've added a game to the schedule. And oddsmakers are really only pricing Green Bay about half a win better from this time last season where we thought that they were projecting a ton of regression, which means, like, relatively speaking, oddsmakers are down on Green Bay again when you look at the team that's won, what, I think they're like 26-6 in the regular season the last 2 years. So it's really an interesting team from that perspective. It's like the market, even when you see a team, hey, at 10 wins, it still says there's not a lot of buy-in here from some gamblers and from some oddsmakers, Todd.
It's a fascinating look, the way you try and parse out how some of these numbers suggest what a realistic outlook is for the season.
Yeah.
Now, you did see the Green Bay Packers division price ping pong all over the place amid speculation that Rodgers wasn't going to be the guy. I saw some shops open as low as minus $1.35. It did take some money on Green Bay, driving it up in that $1.60, $1.70 yes. range. But also have to say one caveat to, and of course, you know, I don't know what FanDuel's liability looks like. I don't know what anybody other shops do. You have to try and elicit and attract some Green Bay money if you were taking money on the Minnesota Vikings at prices of plus 250 or plus 260 when everyone thought there was a realistic chance that Rodgers wasn't going to be the guy.
Yeah, absolutely. You do have to make that adjustment. You do have to change the look of your book in terms of what type of money you are taking in. And I will say this, aside from the O-line, the weapons have improved here. You know, Robert Tonyan's 27. He's in his prime. He's only going to be better. Devontae Adams, we know what he is. He was number one in the NFL, averaged almost 3 yards per route run. Alan Lazard is going to have a better season because he was injured in camp last year and then came back and had the major core injury, and he wasn't himself. Valdez-Scantling flashed at times. He just needs to be a little bit more consistent. You went out and got Amari Rodgers in the third round. A.J. Dillon looks like he's transformed his body a little bit. So the weapons around Aaron Rodgers have improved, right? They brought in Randall Cobb. That's his old buddy. So the weapons have improved a little bit. The question becomes, how far is the dip from Rodgers, and what does the offensive line look like? Those are the two big questions.
Protection, always a big concern. It's one of the units that typically gets overlooked in this fantasy frenzied market that we're in, where people get wowed by skill position talent above all else. When you look at Green Bay on the defensive side of the ball, they go out in the draft and bring in Eric Stokes, their first round pick, a very talented corner out of Georgia. You do lose Christian Kirksey from your linebacking core. And when you look at Green Bay defensively, only the Rams and Seahawks were actually better down the stretch last year than this Packers stop unit. They ranked top 10 in the league in yards per game. They were ninth passing yards per game. They were seventh red zone defense, eighth. But the problem for me, Payne, they only had 18 takeaways. The sack numbers weren't exactly great by any stretch of the imagination. Now, they did hold opposing quarterbacks to a 91 passer rating. But while they were 10th in sacks, they were only 28th in pressure rate. And typically, we know those metrics go hand in hand, where you can defy the odds one season, but if that pressure rate isn't there, it's going to leave a lot more room for regression, despite Green Bay having one of the more talented and still, in my opinion, underrated secondaries in the entire league.
And you're also going to have a scheme shift this year, because you have a new DC in Joe Barry, who was under Sean McVay in Los Angeles when Matt LaFleur was there in 2017. So those two guys are close. That's why he was hired. Joe Barry's been a defensive coordinator two other times, in 2007 and 8 with the Lions, then again in 15 and 16 with Washington. There wasn't improvement to either of those defenses under Barry. If we are keeping things fair, though, Barry was part of the Rams' defensive resurgence in, I believe it was 2017. And then last year, he was Brandon Staley's right-hand man in L.A. You know, let's see if the third time's a charm doing it on his own. The philosophy is going to change, because last year, Mike Pettine ran dime defense on 50% of snaps. Six defensive backs is that formation, okay, on the field at once. League average was around 13%. Pettine used the least amount of nickel, which is five defensive backs. And just based on Joe Barry and Brandon Staley, what they did in L.A. last year, expect nickel defense to be the Packers' base this season. Aaron Rodgers came out this week and said he hasn't seen a defense like this in practice. Far more disguise and coverages. Alan Lazard mimicked that and said basically you have to really think and react post-snap more to find open areas to sit down in based on these different coverage looks. We'll see. The Packers secondary is going to improve, and I think you hit that perfectly. I think two reasons. You're looking at the schedule difficulty of passing offenses, both down-to-down and in explosiveness. That's going to decrease year over year, so a softer projected schedule. And then the other reason is Eric Stokes, you know, the first rounder out of Georgia. He's apparently the real deal. If you look at where the Packers secondary struggled last year, it was defending opposing teams' second receivers. You're always going to be fine on the side of the field where Jair Alexander's locking down, but Kevin King is barely a serviceable starter. Number two wideouts put up the ninth most production against the Packers last year, so if Stokes can come in and contribute early, that's going to be a huge boost. Savage is an absolute monster back there at safety. I think we also have to pay close attention to the Packers front seven. There are some question marks there. Huge regression last season from Za'Darius Smith. He dropped to 52nd in pressure rate after finishing third the year prior. He's been out all camp nursing a back injury. Kenny Clark and Rashawn Gary have to get back as well. They've both been battling through some early season injuries. But for 2 years now, the Packers defense has basically survived on getting to the quarterback and Jair Alexander basically removing the number one receiver from the game. And you mentioned this perfectly. It's that the Packers' team pressure rate dipped to 27th, and their pass rush win rate dropped to 20th. And that's important because it seems like Green Bay has this massive dichotomy in performance when getting pressure versus when they're not. And obviously, right, like defenses do better when they get pressure. I'm not splitting the atom here saying this. But effectively, the Packers had the largest swing in defensive production in the entire league when looking at pressure versus no pressure. Green Bay was dominant when they got pressure, but slightly below average when they weren't. So Za'Darius Smith needs to get healthy. Rashawn Gary needs to continue making strides. We saw his production improve a season ago. I think Joe Barry would be smart if he got Preston Smith more in the mix. The poor guy was dropped in coverage so much last season, he didn't really have a chance to get after the quarterback. But I think Green Bay has the opportunity to perform at an above average rate this season defensively, barring injury to Smith or Kenny Clark. So tiny stock arrow up for this unit, Todd.
Yeah, I think Green Bay is a fascinating team. I mean, I've been critical about their level of physicality and inability to stop the run, but I don't mean to be a full-blown detractor here. We'll see how they perform relative to the market, and we'll get a great indication right out of the gates when they go into a hostile Superdome as road favorites to see what Aaron Rodgers looks like, along with this particular stop unit against an unsettled quarterback situation in New Orleans.
What's really interesting about that, Todd, though, and if Joe Barry mimics Brandon Staley, Brandon Staley is from the analytics mindset. He basically dares you to run the ball. He wants you to run the ball. So that's always the interesting debate is, you know, knowing that running is less efficient, do you just kind of let guys pick up 2-3 yards on first down, bait them into making it a shorter third down distance, and then try to live getting teams off the field on third? And that seemed to be the approach that Brandon Staley took last year. And so let's see if Joe Barry kind of mimics that philosophy in 2021.
Yeah, the one difference being is there's a man in Los Angeles that allows you to disrupt the interior pressure and Aaron Donald that I don't quite think the Packers have on their roster. So we'll see how all those things play out. But last but certainly not least, in the NFC North discussion, the Minnesota Vikings. This is a team who sees their odds to win the division at plus 250 at FanDuel Sportsbook. The win total 8.5. Lay $1.60 to go over that particular number. When you look at 2020, hey, look, it was the first losing record that Coach Zimmer has produced since he was at the controls back in 2014. The schedule starts relatively favorably for the Vikings, at least on paper. And when you look at Minnesota, this team clearly bottomed out last season on the defensive side of the ball all season, but arguably their single worst performance was when you gave up 52 against the New Orleans Saints, and Alvin Kamara found the end zone, what, I think it was 6 times in that particular game. Now, Coach Zimmer, we talked about on the top of the show, didn't play 30 starters in the preseason opener. Everyone doesn't need to panic yet because the Vikings lost 33-6. In comes Clint Kubiak taking over for his old man as offensive coordinator. But when you look at this Vikings team, Payne, hey, look, they have a lot of headliners in the form of Dalvin Cook and Justin Jefferson. I don't think Kirk Cousins gets nearly enough credit for the level of stability he's brought to the quarterback position. But at the same time, it's hard to argue with Cousins' 7-35 career regular season record versus teams that finish the regular season with a winning record, which seems a little bit bizarre for a guy who's got a 91-29 touchdown interception ratio and typically averages more than 4,000 yards a season. With a coach that would rather run the football. When you look at Minnesota offensively, can this team replicate how efficient and how explosive an offense they put on the field each and every week last year?
I'm not sure. And I was shocked how well the Vikings offense performed last season. You know, you lose your coordinator, Kevin Stefanski, won coach of the year and a playoff game for the Browns. Your best weapon in Stephon Diggs left for Buffalo. And somehow Minnesota went from 10th in offensive efficiency to 8th. Top 5 early down offense, red zone offense, and overall explosiveness. So that was a really great performance from Minnesota last year. Now, there was some noise in that numbers if you kind of back out some of the blowout games that they were in where their offense performed down the stretch. The offense didn't look as good, but overall, very good when you think about some of those factors I mentioned with OC and best weapon leaving. You mentioned the coordinator change this season. Vikings go from Gary to son Clint. The schedule of defenses increase in difficulty from below average to fringe top 10. There appears to be a large increase in some of the situational defenses Minnesota faces with big leaps in both third down and red zone defenses based on projections. And I think you probably want to talk about the elephant in the room, and that's the O-line. And
you don't need one of those. You can be fine without one of those. It's perfectly okay.
It seems to be the weakest part of the Vikings every season, you know, and Rick Spielman struggled to improve that line, whether it's in free agency or the draft. The injury bug hit some guys. Others aren't performing to expectation. Christian Darrisaw was penciled in as a day one starting left tackle. Groin surgery and now core muscle surgery. It doesn't look like he's going to be starting week one. Ezra Cleveland penciled in at left guard. This is going to be his third position in 3 years. Played tackle in college and right guard as a rookie. Garrett Bradbury, the 18th pick in 2019, been a massive bust so far. Hopefully year three we see some improvement, but he graded out the 34th best pass blocking center among those that played at least 8 games. The 86th pick in the draft this year, Wyatt Davis, five-star kid from Ohio State, has been good in camp as a run blocker, but from what I am hearing, just a matador in pass protection. And so when you take a guard with the 86th pick, you don't expect him to be third on the depth chart at this position. And that's where he sits right now. Brian O'Neill at right tackle is solid. But I think, you know, where I'm going with this is the unit was supposed to be improved day one in a big way. So much so, Seth Galina wrote an article in May about the most improved units in the league. Think about this for a second. 32 teams. If you break it down to 8 units per team, quarterback, running back, receiver, tight end, O-line, D-line, linebacker, and secondary, that's 256 possible units. Galina had the Vikings O-line as the most improved unit in the NFL. Now, there is time for this to be the case, and I think it's possible Minnesota's O-line improves as the season goes on and the young guys get into the mix, but it's a problem right now, without a question. Everything else offensively does bode well. If Clint Kubiak's anything like Dad, we're going to see some diversity in formations, which is great. Leave opposing defenses guessing. Minnesota played 3 formations, at least 22% of snaps last year. There was probably far too much run focus on second down, which was the Achilles heel of the offense. But if Clint can identify that, there shouldn't be regression even with spotty O-line play. Justin Jefferson in year 2 could become one of the league's best, finished 7th in defensive adjusted value above average among all receivers, almost 2.7 yards per route run. Only Devontae Adams was better. Thielen, one of the best technicians when it comes to route running. It looks like Minnesota has enough bodies where wide receiver 3 should upgrade this season, whether it's KJ Osborne to start or DD Westbrook when healthy, or, you know, later on in the season if Smith Marset can grow within the system. Everyone is saying Irv Smith Jr. is going to have a massive breakout season. He's been all the hype in camp. As a pass catcher, we saw him grow in year 2. Yards per route run, A-dot, and drop percentage, all improved. Does need to get back to his rookie form helping in pass protection, but could be a big year 3 for him. The one thing we do want to keep an eye on is Delvin Cook and his effectiveness catching balls out of the backfield. The schedule of defense is projected to be one of the very best limiting running back production through the air. That's been a huge part of the Vikings offense. In 2019, they averaged more than 11 yards after the catch on targets at or behind the line of scrimmage. Last year was almost 10.5 yards. Delvin Cook's a big part of that, so something to consider if you're potentially between Cook or another back in fantasy. But if Minnesota just gets average O-line play and Cousins plays with added motivation now that the organization hired his replacement, I would expect another top 10 offense that will get far more help from its defense this year.
Well, you mentioned the defense, and I think this is the more interesting unit, in my opinion, in terms of upside yet unknowns at the same time as it pertains to the Vikings. And we can start with the change in personnel. Gone are Mike Hughes and Anthony Harris. In are a bevy of fresh faces, either returning from opt-outs or free agency. So the list starts with Dalvin Tomlinson, who we talked about in the NFC East. I think the Giants are really going to feel his absence in terms of their ability to clog the middle. You bring in Sheldon Richardson. Patrick Peterson isn't the elite lockdown corner at this stage in his career, but he's smart enough to grasp the scheme, and you'd hope that he's in a position to be able to make plays because he's not going to get by on raw speed, as we saw last year in Arizona, where I believe he was called for the most defensive holding slash pass interferences of any defensive back in the league. Xavier Woods enters the fold as well. You bring back Mackenzie Alexander, who spent 1 year in Cincinnati, didn't produce the way I think we both thought he could as a member of that defense. Michael Pierce returns from his opt-out, Bashaud Breeland and Stephen Weatherly, but clearly the biggest name was the man who missed all of last season with a neck injury, Danielle Hunter, but he wasn't the only one, Payne. You lost 35 combined man games from Hunter, Anthony Barr, and Eric Kendricks. Having that trio back along with some of the others we named should allow this defense that hit rock bottom a season ago to bounce back in a big, big way.
No doubt about it. And I think we saw it coming a little bit. You know, in 2018 and 19, when it came time to talk about the Vikings, I said there were tiny things within the makeup of their defense that I didn't like, that pointed towards regression, that they hadn't truly been dominant or even good on early downs to sustain the level of overall defensive success that they were having. Minnesota was excelling in some of the variance areas like third downs and red zones and, you know, were really good not giving up explosives. And even though we saw some tiny dips those seasons, the massive regression we called for came to fruition last year. this was our largest fade in the futures market, both the amount of money and the number of ways we faded Minnesota. And it was this perfect storm. It was obvious regression. It was players leaving in free agency. There were too many new parts learning Zimmer's really complex system in a shortened offseason. And then no fans in the stands for a team that had the best home field advantage under Zimmer. I think we talked about that ad nauseum. It was the largest dip the entire year in home field advantage. Everson Griffin, Xavier Rhodes, Linval Joseph, Trey Waynes, and Mackenzie Alexander all left. Anthony Barr and Eric Kendricks missed 19 games. Danielle Hunter, the best pass rusher, missed the entire season. You had Michael Pierce, who was like the prized free agent acquisition from Baltimore. He never suited up. He opted out. And basically, you had a unit that was losing the top nine guys from one side of the ball effectively. Nobody's overcoming that. But you do dig into some of the numbers, and Zimmer's defense somehow finished a respectable 18th in efficiency while facing the fourth toughest schedule of offenses. And regardless of what we think of Zimmer as a head coach, where he can kind of be stuck in his old ways and a little crotchety, his defensive mind can't be questioned. And so you get Danielle Hunter back, which is just massive. You know, he's starting to finally get some of the love he deserves as the best defensive end in football. You combined 18 and 19. Hunter led the league with 154 pressures. It wasn't a Bosa brother or Watt brother, but it was Danielle Hunter. Top five in pressure rate over those two seasons, but he also does a really good job setting the edge. Top 75 percentile in run defense among qualifying ends. This is a massive get back because the Vikings had the lowest pressure rate of any team since 2012 last year. And even when the Vikings blitzed, they recorded the lowest pressure rate on those blitzes. So it left all the young guys exposed in the back that were learning this complex coverage scheme. You mentioned Delvin Tomlinson. That is going to be a huge improvement. He's one of the better interior linemen, great stopping the run, 8 sacks the last two seasons, and Tomlinson's coming off his best pass rush campaign. Michael Pierce, we mentioned, is coming back. He's one of the best run stuffers in the league. In his interview in the Denver game, I'm not sure if you heard that, but he said, expect some pressure from me. I've spent the last 12 months improving and refining that part of my game. But having those two guys in the middle immediately improves the run defense that finished 30th in rush efficiency and allowed almost 5.2 line yards per carry, the second most all time. Sheldon Richardson was brought back. You mentioned that. It's a reunion. I believe he was there in 2018, so he'll be part of that three-man rotation inside. Eric Kendricks and Anthony Barr back in the middle. Kendricks is arguably a top three cover linebacker, and again last year allowed a 60 rating when targeted, only 5.3 yards per target allowed. Veterans at corner that understand the system will start. I'm not being biased, but few, I think, have talked about Bashaud Breeland's importance to Kansas City's defense the last few seasons more than us. He's now starting for Zimmer, and they're hoping a resurgence from Patrick Peterson. Minnesota did lose Jeff Gladney, the first rounder from 2020, after legal trouble, which absolutely sucks. But the other rookie corner, Cam Dantzler, graded out the third best defender in Minnesota last year in a shortened offseason. So tons of promise there. I think there's some upside with DJ Wonnum as well. Has a chance to be an impact guy in year two. He was the other rookie that was thrown into the fire out of necessity and generated a respectable pressure rate considering all the circumstances. Zimmer likes him so much. That's why Minnesota passed on edge rusher at 14 and traded back despite every mock draft saying differently. Upgrades across the board defensively with signings and health and young guys having a full offseason. You pair those things with a schedule of opposing offenses that goes from top five overall against the pass to roughly average, okay? And so I think we'll see Zimmer's defense get back into the top 10 in defensive efficiency without question this year, Todd.
And when you look at the Vikings' schedule, if they need to build momentum early on, they'll play three games at home, arguably two of their three most difficult opponents for their first six-game stretch. You get Seattle and Cleveland back-to-back weeks, late September, early October, their three road games bookended, Cincinnati and Carolina before they go into their bye week 7. So see if the Vikings are able to make hay early on this season and help us achieve one of our desired goals from a best bet we gave out earlier this season. Encourage folks to go back and listen to the College Football Podcast if you want to know how we've chosen to invest in the Minnesota Vikings. so far this season. As always, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. All the links for not only our 6K football free roll available there, but also to get you to sign up for FanDuelSportsbook.com/bet the board. Take advantage for all those new users out there for some of the generous sign-up options that will be available. And Payne, while recording the podcast, everyone's Messiah, so to speak, as it comes to preseason football, is going to find his ability to cover his 19th straight game to be a little more difficult. Trace McSorley ruled out for the Baltimore Ravens for the remainder of the preseason. So we'll see if John Harbaugh can continue covering games at such a high clip. But before we get out of Dodge here for the NFC North, I wasn't sure if there was an element or a nugget that we failed to hit on for any of these four teams.
No. And I will say this. We kind of warn people that there might not be a best bet on all 13 preseason previews. I don't have one here, but I was hoping that week two NFL preseason lines would be up and widely available. They're not. Go to bettheboardpodcast.com, sign up for the newsletter. Maybe we'll send something out to all of the subscribers there. But what I will say is we can kind of focus here on the Vikings, and I'm going to be a little nicer than you and not make people go back and listen to the college podcast. There are, and I've looked this morning, a handful of shops that are still dealing Minnesota at 8.5 minus $1.60. I still think that's investable. And what's really interesting, when we talked about Minnesota previously, we thought they would go from like 8.5. And I said, hey, this team might actually get to 9.5 by the time things kick off. And a rash of shit has basically unfolded in Minnesota with Jeff Gladney being removed from the team, Christian Darrisaw getting re-injured, seemingly Cousins and Zimmer throwing jabs at each other via the media. And so not the best. And then you had Aaron Rodgers return. And despite all of that, we're now looking at 9.2, the market consensus on the Vikings. It tells you how wildly mispriced this was when we gave it out. But again, if you can find 8.5 minus 60, there's at least two spots I saw this morning that have that. I would make sure you get in on that.
I will say one thing about the preseason, Payne, two games that you and I discussed before coming on the podcast. Let's just say those numbers are no longer widely available
spots that had them.
Yeah, at the two spots that opened, as more and more books have come online, I don't think either of those numbers are going to make it into the mix. We'll have to do some digging.
Yeah.
And should we see some opportunity there?
Well, they weren't available because some of the sharper shops opened a normal number.
No, exactly. They opened the numbers. They opened the numbers where the numbers should have opened. So we'll see if there's a little bit of wiggle room for any of these games. With a full slate on Saturday, you'll have one game Thursday night, two games on Friday, and even Sunday night and Monday night football next week. So I'm sure we'll be able to dig into something when we reconvene on Thursday to attack yet another division. Half of the National Football League officially down, broken down, easy for me to say, as eloquently as we possibly can. Again, for those folks, if this is the first time you found the Bet the Board podcast and listen to the NFC North, go back and listen to the AFC North, the AFC East, the NFC East, and all five Power Five conferences from the college football ranks. Plenty of content as the season inches closer by the minute, by the hour, by the second. For Payne Insider, I'm Todd Furman with the Minnesota Vikings win total ticket in hand in the NFC North. We'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.